Members, 1 o'clock, having arrived, we will call the meeting of the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee to order. There is a quorum. First item on the agenda is the minutes of Monday, February 10th, 2025. Representative Cagle, moves to approve the minutes of Monday, February 10th, 2025. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Today, before we even get started, I just want to again thank everybody in the committee and the public that was with us or watching that was with us at our last meeting. Went a little long and we went into had an evening session, but I appreciate everybody's time. Today we will have an overview of the Corridors of Commerce program. It's proven mostly popular in the last couple of sessions, and just a good opportunity to kind of better understand what that is. And then later on, we will have a short presentation by the Transportation Alliance. Tomorrow, it's Transportation Day here at the Capitol. And then we will move to hear House File 14. So presenting for us is our House Research, very capable, and Mr. Matt Burris. If you could start with your presentation and tell us the pertinent parts of the Corridors of Commerce program.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Burris with House Research. As you noted, I was asked to provide some background and general overview information on the Corridors of Commerce program. So to start, just to give you a sense of what I'll be covering, a little bit of kind of general overview, intro to the program, talking about the program design, looking some at the funding and finance aspects of the program, touching on some of the projects, and then wrapping up with a bit of a discussion around changes that occurred over the course of the program's history. So to begin, to just provide some general context to the program, this is for the trunk highway system. It's for projects throughout the state, and it was for trunk highways. So the interstate system, U.S. highways, other trunk highways. So it's kind of looking at the state highway level. It was initially established in legislation in 2013. It's gone through a couple of rounds of revisions through legislative changes over the years. It's administered by the Department of Transportation and can be viewed as a specialty program in the terminology that I think the legislative auditor had used in a report. So that is outside of the general project development process that MnDOT undertakes to determine what projects to perform.
Mr. Burris, if you could pull the microphone a little bit closer, the audio in the room is that would help. I'm sure they can hear it online, but that would help in the room. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I hope this is better. It seemed loud to me, so I was actually kind of moving away a little bit. So this program is a competitive project selection process-based undertaking to determine what projects receive funding. And it has been funded through legislative appropriations on a periodic but somewhat regular basis. So at the outset of the program, it had some initial funding. It's received additional dollars over the years, and we'll be returning to that a little bit later. So the basic articulated goals of the program are roughly twofold. One is to provide for capacity expansion on the trunk highway system, particularly looking at gaps or bottlenecks in the system. And then the second is looking at freight movement and improving commerce, economic competitiveness, and freight movement. At the time that the program was created, I think it could be contended that there were some other considerations before the legislature in designing and implementing a program of this type. One of the things is the strong tradition that had existed throughout the years in legislative selection or not selection of specific projects. Generally speaking, the funding for transportation that's enacted by the legislature has provided large amounts in general statutory direction to the Department of Transportation as far as what trunk highway projects or what project work to perform without specifying a series of specific projects. At the time as well, MnDOT had expressed some concern around the funding level and wanting to prioritize in its and had put in some of its planning an emphasis on program maintenance, and that can be viewed as being in tension with interests among some legislators, some stakeholders in expanding, providing for capacity expansion on the trunk highway system. And there were also sort of similar to that, stakeholder perspectives on specific projects that were of interest and that could be viewed as being in tension, to some extent at least, with the general project selection process that MnDOT has had and still continues to utilize in determining what its work plan is. So moving into the project, program design, one feature of it is there are some limitations on what kinds of projects can be selected within the program. First, a project needs to fit into one of two classifications that are set up in the authorizing legislation. One is capacity development, which I'll touch on, and the second is a kind of general improvement to freight access and mobility. There are a couple other features to the eligibility. One is a readiness component of the project being able to commence with construction activity in what in current law is a 4-year period. There's also a ability to identify what the costs are element as part of the eligibility, as well as requirements around the project not already being part of what's programmed as part of MnDOT's work and being within a subset of the overall trunk highway system that is the national highway system, which is some of the heavier volume roads that are part of a federal designation. So capacity development is a variety of potential project types that are listed out, but it essentially refers to things like adding an interchange or conversion from an intersection to an interchange, so stoplights to controlled access, extending or adding an additional lane, or shifting from a 2-lane to a 4-lane, or establishing additional divided highway. The program design also has a project selection, a couple of steps or features in that process. The first basic stage is a solicitation followed by review. So there's an open solicitation, and this has been revised over the years, but there's always been an element of the program where there's an open call for interested stakeholders and local entities to submit ideas for what they would like to be considered for project work to happen throughout the state. That process is then utilized to collect up a set of projects that are potential candidates, and local screening entities are tasked with performing a review of that list, filtering it down, and then submitting recommendations to MnDOT for further scoring and analysis. And as part of that process, MnDOT takes a look at the eligibility of those project ideas to see if that project proposal concept or what have you fits within the statutory requirements. So from that, MnDOT has a list of projects and goes through an evaluation and scoring process. There are a number of statutory criteria that MnDOT uses, and has the department has then developed some matrices and measurement tools for performing the evaluation against each of those criteria. From that, there's a scoring that's assigned against all of the criteria. Those scores are added up, and the list of projects is set out in a ranked order based on those scoring. And roughly speaking, projects are then funded on the basis of available funds going down the ranking list. But it's not actually just one list. So that brings us to how the funding gets further allocated. So on the funding side of things, so the dollars that are available in each project selection round are divided into three allocations, kind of three pots. And these are geographic areas of the state. And within each area, there's a percentage range of how much of the available dollars can go towards that area. So the first of the areas is called the metro allocation and is bounded by Interstates 494 and 694. So in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, if you envision a kind of donut hole around the central core cities and bounded by those interstates, that's sort of the first regional section. If you can envision a ring of counties outside of that donut hole, that is the metro connector second allocation. That's the 11 county area in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And then regional center is the third allocation bucket, if you will, and that is the rest of the state. So the funding amount that can go to each of those allocations has a range, so there's some degree of limitation, but also flexibility depending on the nature of dollars involved with various projects that have been scored. There's also another sort of side set-aside element that is designed to try and address a sort of chicken and the egg issue, where there could be insufficient information to evaluate a project that's just getting going, where you know perhaps there's a known issue, but there hasn't been a lot of scoping or initial preliminary design work sufficient to do the kind of scoring that's called for in the core program. Or one issue that had come up at points over the time of the existence of the program is sometimes those projects that have already gotten some amount of funding to do initial development are then better suited and kind of in better shape to receive additional funding. So the legislature established a readiness development set-aside or allocation that's up to 10% of the funds to accelerate projects that are more in their infancy. And so these dollars are available for some of the initial project work to get the project developed enough so that the criteria that are in place or requirements that are in place around being ready to be constructed, having a total project cost estimate, and having sufficient information to perform the scoring, would that kind of work could be done under this readiness development. So the scoring methodology is different for this use of dollars. One other aspect of the core program design is a review process or element that's really got two parts. One is a legislative report that is, for the most part, due annually. And then the second is in roughly every other report, there's an evaluation that MnDOT is directed to do around the program effectiveness and its outcomes. So that's roughly the layout of how the program is designed. Moving into the funding, there have, as I've mentioned, been several rounds of appropriations and dollars allocated to the program since its inception, amounting to a little over $1.7 billion. This, for the most part, has been trunk highway bonds. That's what started the program, was a trunk highway bonding authorization. In later years, a base appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund was also enacted, and that's at $25 million per year. There's also been, at least for one of the selection rounds, an allocation that MnDOT identified from its general state road construction appropriation. So the dollars have been spread out as far as legislative authorizations and appropriations, but the project selection rounds are expressed a little bit differently and have been, you know, dollars that have been appropriated in multiple years have been bundled together into project selection rounds. So the reason I try to note that is because this table is designed, and it continues, by the way, onto the next slide. This table is designed to show the years of appropriations in the case of the Trunk Highway Bonding Authority, Trunk Highway Fund appropriations, and the MnDOT allocation. It shows the fiscal year in which the dollars are made available. But it also shows how the Trunk Highway Bonding authorizations and appropriations have been structured. And in that case, the years are referring to the session year in which the law was enacted. And the general pattern for how the program has been funded beyond just that $25 million annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund has been bonding for a series of years, and the dollars have been spread out. That's to some extent been a function of available debt capacity, and to some extent a function of how the legislature has chosen to allocate some dollars into future years. So there's been some overlap in when dollars are made available. So this next slide just wraps up the rest of the years of the table, and there are some notes that I mostly had tried to highlight in describing what the overall funding picture has looked like. Moving then to what projects have been selected, there's been a variety of types of capacity expansion, and this is a list here of some of the example types. It has ranged from, you know, adding lanes, intersection conversion, conversion from a two-lane to a four-lane highway. At the outset of the program, one of the examples that had been discussed was highways where there's a two-lane segment and then a four-lane segment and then a return to a two-lane segment. And that was, you know, not the exclusive goal of the program to fund that kind of roadway, but that's an example of the kind of work that that resulted in a continuous four-lane stretch. There are a couple of maps, and I do have, I know that's probably pretty small, I do have I don't have copies, but I do have available a more blown up version of both the statewide and the Twin Cities metro area maps. These are available in the legislative report that MnDOT produces. And is just to give you a sense of the kind of locations and areas where project work has been performed under the program. The last thing I'll touch on are some of the changes in the program over the course of its existence. This isn't to go through every aspect of legislative change or all the details, but is really intended to provide a little bit of context for the program design as it stands now and some of the circumstances that brought that about. So one of the highlights looking back at since the program had started in 2013 was the results of a evaluation that the Office of the Legislative Auditor, or OLA, had put out. That evaluation was looking at highway project selection more generally, but it did include the Corridors of Commerce program and had a couple of findings around the how the program had been implemented, raising concerns about consistency and the project selection process that was undertaken. Following the release of that report, the legislature in 2017 enacted a variety of program design changes, and that included a requirement of all of the statutory criteria to be selected, to be utilized in project selection, and a limitation on the department adding additional criteria. Regional balance was also added as one of the criteria at that point. In 2018, in response to the legislative direction, MnDOT had revised its project selection and scoring activity and went with, in a more formal sense, a kind of soft 50-50 split on the regional allocation question. That, by the way, I believe is what had been in place and used by the agency in its previous selection rounds. So roughly it was targeting a 50% of the dollars going to the Twin Cities metropolitan area and 50% going to greater Minnesota. In the spring of 2018, MnDOT announced, as a result of this project selection process, a series of projects. And there was some objection and concern raised by some members of the legislature and some stakeholders as to whether that balance reflected a balance of statewide interest, in part because a couple of the projects that were selected were in District 3, just outside of the kind of core Twin Cities metropolitan area. The legislative response after that was to authorize some additional funding, but direct those dollars a little bit differently, using the same scoring results, but essentially working down the list of selected projects to identify project work that would need to happen in other counties. Some additional discussion took place following the 2018 activity. That resulted in 2023 of further legislative revisions to the project selection process. In those discussions, MnDOT expressed concerns about the number of projects being submitted in this open solicitation type process and some of the challenges around identifying, having sufficient information and performing the scoping necessary to do scoring activity. And the regional balance question really felt to the agency and arguably to others in the legislature as to not having been sufficiently resolved. So the 2023 legislation made some modifications that reflect what I described for the current program, including to add the local screening entity stage as kind of a filtering before evaluation and scoring by MnDOT. To create those three regional allocation buckets and have this separate allocation category for readiness development. That, Mr. Chair, is a review of the program and a little bit of the history. I'm happy to go to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. That was very much appreciated. We will have time for some member questions. Let Mr. Marble know. I'll start with you've got on the back a couple of the resources on there, and one of them is the MnDOT website, and maybe you can answer, but I was trying to look previously. Is there, on that website, does it list the projects that are kind of in queue? Or what would we find there? Somebody's from the departments here, but...
Mr. Chair and members, I need to take a look again. I believe there might be, I know there is a history of past projects that might be in need of updating with the latest selection round, but there is some general program overview and some history and a little bit on prior guidance of kind of how they had done the program design previously.
Okay. We can search on that website a little bit, but it sounds like it might be a good reference and for some information. My other quick question is back to that 10% of funds readiness. That's 10% of the funds helps projects get ready, to clarify. I understood that right?
Mr. Chair, yes. It's really to help the projects get started, so initial scoping design type activities.
Very good. We have questions. Representative Kraft, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Burris. At a high level, I just want to make sure, I've heard so many good things about this program, that people like it, but What problem was it created to solve? Like, why does it exist separate from the normal highway funding stream? And is the funding noticeably different than that, or does it come from what we would normally have for other highway projects?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, the discussion at the time, and in my recollection, so you know, a little bit of a grain of salt perhaps there, but I'd say it focused on a tension between the projects selected by MnDOT through their regular programming process and what some legislators, what the legislature, what some stakeholders expressed as projects that should have been a higher priority. So it could be viewed as a legislative response to the tension between the project selection outcomes in the regular programming and specific projects that were being identified or had been raised as ones that were of local interest for a large number of years but had never gotten funding. And I had kind of tried to highlight some of those tensions in an earlier slide. The other aspect was at the time, there was a lot of focus in MnDOT's planning and in its kind of program plans that there'd be a pretty heavy emphasis on maintenance of the system as opposed to expansion and balancing the maintenance activities and all of the putting a high degree of dollars towards maintaining the system as opposed to addressing capacity or bottleneck concerns. And where that balance was, arguably the program could be viewed as trying to find a recalibration to some extent on that. You had a second part of the question, and I had it in mind, and then I lost it. I'm sorry.
Representative Kraft, clarify your second question quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the funding that's provided for this, is it like a subset of the, does it come out of what we would normally fund for highway, for highways, or is it like, I'm looking at, or is it like thought of differently? Like how to think about that?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, it's really the same funding sources. So trunk highway bonds, often with trunk highway bonds and trunk highway fund appropriations are the funding source for the trunk highway system by and large for all, you know, maintenance and state road construction. This is funded in the same way. Some of the trunk highway bonding authorizations that included appropriations for corridors of commerce also had appropriations for state road construction generally. I can't remember all of the details behind the various bond authorizations, but that was I believe a pretty regular, a little bit towards corridors of commerce, a little bit towards SRC.
10-second follow-up to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the right way to think about it then is what is gone for corridors of commerce isn't available for other stuff? It's like one big pot and we're carving out something for this purpose?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, in the sense that that there's only so much trunk highway fund dollars and trunk highway debt capacity, you know, each appropriation that's enacted for trunk highway system will reduce the available dollars for other purposes for trunk highways.
No. Thank you for those questions, Representative Kraft. Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Burris. I just have a question about the funding share and the allocation. Can you just share a little bit of background on how those percentages come about, like what they were based on?
Mr. Burris.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, there were a couple of years of discussions at the legislature around how to draw how to find a balance in where dollars would flow throughout the state. And this was the solution that the legislature enacted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. And there is a good history, so your questioning is very relevant. Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Burris, for your report. My question is with regards to the technical advisory board recommendations and the 10% readiness, does that technical advisory board recommendation happen with the plan itself, or in some cases is it part of the readiness money that's there to finish projects and kind of make them fit?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think I'm not quite following.
Representative Murphy, can you clarify your question a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, I may have this mixed up too, but the Technical Advisory Board on trunk highways is for any type of adaptations that need to have to put it more into a climate, condition. So for the road, and so the Technical Advisory Board is the board that actually decides on some of these things, whether or not they're acceptable. And then we talked about the 10% readiness, and that's kind of a float for changes in the project. And I was just wondering, does the advisory board's recommendation, are they only in the plan itself, or do they sometimes happen in this kind of slush that's happening with the 10% readiness?
Mr. Burris, with the new greenhouse gas mitigation efforts and the technical advisory board of those mandates, how does that interact with the corridors of commerce? If I can help Representative Murphy streamline his question.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. So first, I described the 10% allocation as part of what MnDOT would have flexibility in directing dollars that are made available for the Corridors of Commerce program. If you're thinking of talking about the technical advisory board related to the greenhouse gas emissions mitigation activity, that board looks at the technical aspects of how to evaluate the impacts of a given project. So I'm not sure that I would describe it as a direct connection between the activities of the two. So the 10% dollar amount is really a project development pot that could be used to get a project started and kind of do initial scoping, initial design work in order to get it ready enough to perform scoring in a subsequent round Corridors of Commerce funding. The greenhouse gas emissions mitigation activity would be an analysis that's required of some trunk highway projects that takes a look at the overall greenhouse gas emissions impacts of that project, and the technical advisory board for that would be looking at the measurement, modeling, and tools around that analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. So just want to get some clarification on some things. So last session, we passed a bill to create a Minnesota Traffic Advisory Council, and part of that bill was to address all the traffic fatalities. And one of the things that the Traffic Safety Council was going to do was present a list at the beginning of session. I think they're going to do it sometime in February, a list of the most dangerous highways, roads, intersections, so that we can prioritize, which areas we need to put funding into. And I'm curious if you've heard about that and if that's intersecting with this Corridors of Commerce and how that would work, because it seems like, you have your own ranking for this and you score it a certain way, but the Traffic Safety Board might score it possibly differently. Curious about that. And then also my second question would be, is the scoring and the ranking of the projects public? I saw, and when I looked it up, it seems like the projects prior to 2021 are public and they're on the website, but I'm curious if you have a list of what the top ranked priorities are.
Mr. Burris and Representative Ream, Mr. Burris is House Nonpartisan Research, so he doesn't, he's explaining the bill for us. It's not, he doesn't make the decisions, just to clarify if that wasn't clear. But yeah, can you answer Representative Ream's questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ream, so to the first question on the kind of intersectionality, the solicitation process is open. So there could, if there were, you know, particular projects that are identified as safety concerns, and also related to the expansion aspects in order to fit the qualifying eligibility elements of the nature of the project under the program, you know, those could be submitted, and then local entities in the filtering and review process, area transportation partnerships or the Met Council or counties would, you know, evaluate and take a look at and review those kinds of proposals. So it's potentially projects that are identified from a traffic safety standpoint could be ones that are at least started to be looked at in the screening process. I'm sorry, I forgot the second question.
Thank you for the explanation. I understand that there are some MnDOT people from that help manage and run the Corridors of Commerce program. If you have some insight, we'd appreciate it. We do have a little bit of time to learn a little bit more and help answer some of the questions. If you could please identify yourself for the record and for us, and then offer some insights.
I'm Nicole Lestat. I'm the Capital Planning Director at MnDOT, and I oversee the Corridors of Commerce program.
Great. Representative Ream, would you mind just kind of rephrasing your question as concisely as you can?
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. So I was curious if it was public, if the information is public. I looked it up, and it looked like the projects that were ranked and scored prior to 2021 are on the website, and maybe they are for the current ones, but I didn't see them. So I was asking if that's public information.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yeah.
If I could ask you to restate your name, I probably talked over you and we weren't able to catch it.
Nicole Lestat.
Thank you, Ms. Lestat.
Yes, so in regards to the listing, there's a history tab for the page that does list the previously selected projects from 2018 and before. The most recently selected projects are listed in the announcement on the homepage for 2023. We're in the process of updating the website to get ready to launch a call for that readiness advancement funding. And so we're in the process of making those web changes currently.
Ms. Westcott, would you be able to provide to the committee the projects, if it's not on the website, you can just direct us to that, but the more recent ones that you're getting ready, just to provide it to the committee as well when you have that data compiled?
There is a announcement as well as the Excel spreadsheet is on there that lists all of the awards and scores for all submitted projects.
Excellent. Representative Cagle, and then we should probably move on to the rest of the presentation.
Thank you. I think this question is for Ms. Lestat as well. So when the Corridors of Commerce projects are evaluated, do they take into account any like alternatives besides highways, rail, any kind of alternative modes of transportation that still can help with commerce and economic development?
Ms. Lestat?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cagle. As far as the capital program, as it had been up to now of selecting the projects, those criteria that Mr. Burris had mentioned in kind of what's selected, it's laid out there specifically. There isn't not any consideration in the scoring process for any other type of mode directly. The only link to other modes of transportation is related to the policy objective criteria and how that relates to the statewide multimodal transportation plan. And so there's a little bit with that multimodal connection, but not much.
Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Yep, one last question. So I'm looking at the history highlights of the program change slide, and I'm wondering, so under 2017, it says evaluation with all and no additional statutory criteria. Does that exempt the Quarters of Commerce program from, for instance, the greenhouse gas emissions VMT goals or the climate action framework from the state?
Ms. Westat?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Cagle, we are assuming that any Corridors of Commerce project is required to meet that GHG impact assessment, and we are planning to provide information in line with what that group advised for these projects so that they could get ready and to do that.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you. And so, Ms. Westwood, would that does that include the vehicle miles traveled reduction goals as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Cagle. The focus has been on the GHG impact assessment, not directly related to the VMT part.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your insight. I was kind of looking around for MnDOT here, so I appreciate you being with us today and providing that. I'm sure if members have additional questions or follow-up, we know who to get a hold of. Mr. Burris, thank you very much for that thorough overview, and I found it very valuable. Next, we will move on to Ms. Margaret Donahoe. She's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. During pre-session, I did a lot of work with outside and trying to provide our members with overall transportation information and education. And so we know that tomorrow you're celebrating Transportation Day. I hope some of the members have an opportunity to visit your event. We have about 15 minutes to present, and so we can leave some time for questions. And I will just kick it off a little bit. We appreciate all the efforts that the Transportation Alliance does to advise the legislature. I will note, not particularly partisan, but also not particularly picky about how the revenues get derived to transportation. So those of us that have more fiscal constraints and concerns, we are working towards the same effort, but sometimes we do not align specifically with where the revenue comes from. But I am glad that you're here. Thank you for your presentation and time, and we appreciate members paying attention. I think there'll be a good overview, and I've enjoyed the work that you've done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, and we really appreciate this opportunity to speak to you today. Tomorrow is Transportation Day at the Capitol. We have over 100 folks coming from around the state to hear from you, talk to you, advocate for transportation. And you're all invited to stop by in the morning or over lunch. We'll be at the Carpenter's offices on Olive Street, not too far from here. And I'd love to have you stop by. So just a little history for those who are not as familiar. The Transportation Alliance was actually formed in 1893 by farmers, county commissioners, bicyclists, people who wanted more paved roads in Minnesota. Started as Minnesota Good Roads. And in 1989, the organization then evolved to become the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, which today includes local governments, industry representatives, labor, business, transit, and other modes. We bring groups together to build consensus and advocate for additional investments in all parts of Minnesota's transportation. The Alliance has been a leader in campaigns to enact significant new funding for transportation over the years, including the constitutional amendment to dedicate all of the motor vehicle sales tax to transportation in 2006, the major transportation funding package passed in 2008 that included the first increase in the gas tax since 1989, coalition work to support the dedication of the sales tax on auto repair parts and leased vehicles in 2017, and the major transportation funding package passed in 2023, including the new metro sales tax, the retail delivery fee, and indexing the motor fuel tax. Throughout the years, we have been a vocal champion for transportation funding in the capital bonding bill, including the local road improvement program, the local bridge program, funding for all modes, including ports and waterways, rail, and transitways. So this year, I think you have copies of handouts we provided, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but this year, Alliance members are focused on, first of all, maintaining the gains that we have made in past years. Passage of a major capital bonding bill that includes significant funding for transportation programs, and opportunities to increase dedicated revenue for transportation. Suggestions for increased funding include accelerating the dedication of the sales tax on auto repair parts so we don't have to wait until 2033, eliminating the $100 order threshold on the retail delivery fee, increasing the current electric vehicle fee of $75 annually to $200, and instituting a fee at public charging stations, along with providing additional state dollars to match federal discretionary grants awarded to the state through the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA. As you may recall, 2 years ago, the legislature set aside some funding to help with matching federal grants. And the good news, I guess, is that we have been awarded quite a bit in federal discretionary grants, but now those funds have pretty much been spoken for. So if we want additional federal grants, it would definitely help to have some state funding to match those grants. The Corridors of Commerce program, as you heard a lot about, has been extremely important as a way to prioritize corridors that support freight movement and economic development. And I would just add that from my recollection, when the program was created, and it was kind of Representative Hornstein's baby, a lot of the reasoning behind it had to do with major projects. And this is an issue in a lot of states. Some states have a major projects commission, like Wisconsin, because it's a big challenge when you have a project that's several hundred million dollars. And in our case, no one MnDOT district could handle these major projects in their regular budgets. And so what would happen is the projects just didn't happen. They got kicked down the road again and again and again. And so a lot of the rationale behind creating the Corridors of Commerce program was to find a way and to accumulate a significant amount of trunk highway bonds so that it could handle these bigger projects. And so we can see the results, thanks to the creation of this program, that highways like 14, which languished for many years and had major safety concerns, because when you have corridors that go from two lanes to four lanes to two lanes, it's inherently a safety problem. So corridors like 14, 23, 212, they definitely benefited a lot from this program, and we're finally able to see some progress. The expansion of 94, 494, the completion of 610, and improvements to 169 have all benefited from the Corridors of Commerce program. So we see a lot of benefit to this, and of course there are ongoing needs. So we think it's important to continue to fund that and to continue to leverage trunk highway bonds. Bonds have become an important factor in financing highway and bridge projects since 2008, when the legislation included $1.8 billion in trunk highway bonds. And at the same time, the legislature required MnDOT to establish a policy for debt service on trunk highway bonds so that we wouldn't go overboard and have so much debt service that it would overwhelm the trunk highway fund. So the current policy is 20% of state revenue in the trunk highway fund. We don't want to go beyond that in terms of the cost of debt service. The transportation budget bill passed in 2023 did include $599 million in trunk highway bonds, with $153 million of that for the Corridors of Commerce program. According to MnDOT, because of additional federal and state revenue into the Trunk Highway Fund, the fund currently has the capacity under the debt guideline to support an additional $630 million in trunk highway bonds, which would make a huge difference in completing some additional highway and bridge projects. Our members would like to see an additional authorization of at least $400 million in trunk highway bonds for the Corridors of Commerce program. While the state is ultimately responsible for all debt, the fact that trunk highway bonds are repaid from a separate fund with constitutionally dedicated revenue should mean that these bonds are treated differently. And in fact, legislation to authorize trunk highway bonds only requires a simple majority, unlike the supermajority required to authorize GO bonds. So we greatly appreciate the additional funding that was included in the 2023 transportation funding bill. Leveraging those dollars by authorizing additional trunk highway bonds will make much more of a difference and improve safety and mobility all across the state. Minnesota's transportation system continues to rely on a diversity of dedicated funds. That really has been what has helped us is having a number of different revenue sources, three of which are constitutionally dedicated, but also other new innovative ideas as well. Maintaining and improving the fourth largest road system in the country can feel like a daunting task, and significant unfunded needs remain for all modes in transportation. But progress has been made over the last decades to find new revenue sources, dedicate additional dollars to highways and transit, and watch the build-out of highway and transit networks that are moving products and people in a safer and more effective way. We look forward to building on this progress and working with you to make the transportation system work for Minnesota's residents and businesses. I'm happy to turn it over.
Thank you, Ms. Donahoe. Yes, it looks like there's another guest. I believe it's Ms. Foster from Otter Tail County as the county engineer. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Margaret. For the record, my name is Kristen Foster, Otter Tail County engineer. And today I'm here on behalf of the Transportation Alliance, Association of Minnesota Counties, and Minnesota County Engineers Association to share a perspective on the public benefits that come along with state programs for regionally significant roads and bridges. Otter Tail County is also an active member of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which is a voluntary organization of Minnesota's faster growing counties that together are home to over 44% of the state's residents. First, I want to thank you for having us here today. Minnesota's transportation system forms the backbone of the state's economy by providing for the movement of people and products throughout the state and beyond. In reviewing the governor's proposed budget, I will speak to the importance of three programs for local roads and bridges: the Local Bridge Replacement Program, the Local Road Improvement Program, and the Local Government Roads Wetland Replacement Program. Thanks to major funding passed during the 2023 session, including indexing the state fuel tax and establishing the transportation advancement account, the funding gap was reduced. In the meantime, the absence of a 2024 capital bonding bill, combined with the pace of inflation, increased the backlog of shovel-ready infrastructure investments, which will improve travel for all modes of transportation and put people to work when these potential projects are under construction. One of the benefits of these local road and bridge programs is most of the money is invested within the first year or two of enactment for these local programs. Minnesota's counties have jurisdiction of more than 44,534 of the state's 143,112 miles of roads and highways. Counties and other local governments oversee approximately 80% of all bridges in our great state, and 742 bridges are in poor condition, according to MnDOT's 2024 annual bridge report. Additionally, there are 1,259 bridges with restrictions on the weight or size of vehicles that may cross them. Given a local bridge replacement program appropriation between $160 million to $200 million in general obligation bond funds, local agencies, including Otter Tail County, are well prepared to deliver bridge repair or replacement projects to keep residents and visitors connected to their workplaces, schools, and recreation destinations. As funds are appropriated for the local bridge replacement program, projects are selected based on a compilation of county board and city council resolutions that comprise the comprehensive bridge replacement priority list. This program was established in 1976. Currently, the five-year list of needs includes 948 bridges with an estimated total replacement cost over $847 million. The money in the program has been exhausted, and there's a waiting list of ready-to-build bridge projects in the pipeline. Speaking on behalf of Otter Tail County, we have one closed bridge, which impacts hundreds of cars per day, and we're hopeful there may be support for the local bridge replacement program to facilitate replacement of the Bluff Creek Bridge as soon as this fall or during the 2026 construction season. For the local road improvement program, the Transportation Alliance seeks an appropriation between $150 million to $200 million in GO bonds, including $20 million in general fund cash. The cash portion provides more flexibility to deliver the projects that legislators want to see happen when funds are appropriated for this program and selected through the LRIP Advisory Committee. LRIP benefits counties, cities, and township road authorities, with the funds subsequently programmed amongst three subaccounts, including roads of regional significance, the rural road safety account, and the trunk highway corridor account. For the most recent solicitation in 2023, there were 378 applications requesting $417.1 million in funds towards almost $922 million in transportation system needs. Only 86 of these projects can be selected based on available funding at that time. The state's dollars stretch further when matched with local and other funding sources through this program, and together we can improve more miles of road than would otherwise be accomplished without your support. Last but certainly not least, I want to highlight the local government roads wetland replacement program. Minnesota law requires the Board of Water and Soil Resources replace wetlands and wetland areas of public waters that are drained or filled by qualifying reconstruction, repair, and rehabilitation projects conducted by local road authorities. This program facilitates predictable permitting for such projects, as well as larger and higher quality replacement wetlands, which is more cost efficient for the taxpayers. For the purposes of mitigating unavoidable wetland impacts, the state is divided in 10 bank service areas. Five of these areas have a balance of less than 1 year of demand. To sustain the streamlining that this program provides, an appropriation of $26 million of one-time monies is imminently needed. Looking to the future, annual funding necessary to maintain and support the wetland replacement program is estimated at $9.5 million per year. Receiving both adequate and predictable funds is important considering the timeline to restore wetlands and receive related regulatory approvals is typically 7 to 10 years. In closing, I'll share my perspective that building and maintaining a safe and well-integrated transportation system that efficiently moves people and products has long been a basic responsibility of government, and we look forward to working with our representatives as my colleagues and I review bills and collaborate with you this session. The local road and bridge system has a funding gap of approximately $1 billion per year, and the governor's budget does not adequately address the needs of these local transportation programs that rely on a bonding bill. There are millions of dollars in infrastructure investments throughout Minnesota that are ready to be delivered if a bonding bill passes this session. On behalf of the Alliance Board of Directors, AMC, MCEA, and MICA, thanks again for this time to introduce our messages.
Thank you, Ms. Foster. We have a question from Representative Murphy, who is from your area, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Kristen, for being here. It's nice to see Otter Tail people down here working. My question for you is just has to do with the impact of greenhouse gas mandates on our roads and bridges, and even the wetlands program on our the cost and the doability of making sure those are done. So what will be the impact that you see in Otter Tail County?
Ms. Foster, real quick, if you wouldn't mind.
Chair Kosnick, Representative Murphy, on behalf of counties, we're most concerned of the cost of mitigating greenhouse gases on the trunk highway system, and if that program were to be expanded to other projects, Specific to Otter Tail County, I can share there are projects that wouldn't be moving forward this construction season if not for the local government roads wetland replacement program. We were fortunate to get one of our applications for Highway 1 in just south of Fergus Falls just in time before the credits were depleted.
Thank you, Ms. Foster. Representative Tabke has a question, and Representative Jones, and please be brief. We have a number of testifiers on the next file, and we will be voting on that today.
Got it. Thank you, Chair Kosnick, and thank you very much for being here. On Monday in Transportation Committee, we passed out of committee Representative Joy's bill to dramatically put a massive hole in how we fund transportation in Minnesota without any revenue to pull that back in again and make sure that that is whole. And so I'm just wondering from a county perspective and from a Transportation Alliance perspective as to what that massive bust in the budget that will bridges will crumble, roads will have massive potholes.
To the question, Representative Tabke.
Getting there.
I understand the question. I believe the testifier does. We're going to keep moving. So wrap up, please.
Thank you, Chair. So with that, wondering what that will do to your budgets and ability to maintain and have safety road projects into the future.
I'm happy to take that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And Representative Tabke. Yes, we do have a lot of concerns about that. As I mentioned on Monday evening, we strongly support the retail delivery fee and indexing of the fuel tax.
Ms. Donahoe, did you testify on Monday?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay. Wrap up your comments as quickly as possible so we can get the other representatives' questions.
So we would definitely see an impact if that revenue were not replaced.
Thank you. Representative Jones, real quick.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick, and thank you, Ms. Donahoe and Ms. Foster. I also have to say I appreciate seeing another female engineer. I am one as well, and so it's great to have that camaraderie. One thing that Ms. Donahoe had mentioned, that we have the fourth largest system out of any state in the country, and it's kind of baffling to me. You know, we're also 12th in size and 22nd in population. And so, you know, seeing this gap, it's hard for me to also think how we're going to expand our funding by, you know, 44%. So how do you square that circle? You know, what do you think about, you know, the size of our system and this gap? Like, what can we do?
Ms. Donahoe, about 20, 30 seconds, please.
Yep. Really quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it has been talked about a lot, the size of the system, which has a lot to do with this being an agricultural state. Most of the miles of road are on the local system, township system, small cities. So there has been some talk about some roads possibly going back to gravel. But access is critical. So there isn't a whole lot that can be done in terms of the size of the system. But we do need to continue to do everything we can to provide adequate resources to maintain the system into the future.
Thank you, Ms. Donahoe. And members, I would again remind you that tomorrow there's a whole basically a symposium on a lot of these topics and beyond that I think members of the committee would find very interesting, and that is the purpose why we invited Ms. Donahoe and the Alliance here. So we want to keep a narrow timeline, so thank you for your presentation. Next, we have House File 14, Representative Robbins, and Representative Robbins, welcome to the Transportation Committee. We don't see you here often. I will move your House File 14 to the General Register. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate you hearing this bill. This is an attempt to help save taxpayers money by pausing the construction of the Blue Line light rail until the Southwest light rail line is complete, and then we can evaluate whether Blue Line still makes sense. So just to help people understand the costs involved and the history of the overruns and time overruns on light rail, Southwest Light Rail has 16 transit stations and 14.5 miles. It was first suggested in 2011, and it was supposed to open in 2018 for the cost of $1.25 billion. at 2018 when it was supposed to be open. It was reevaluated and it was going to cost $2 billion and was going to open in 2023. Now we're in 2025 and the cost is projected to be $2.9 billion and supposedly it will open in 2027. So that's a 232% increase in the cost, members. We cannot afford to make this same mistake again with the Blue Line. So just to give you the level set on the Blue Line, it was originally proposed to start work on it in 2014 at a cost of $999 million, and it was going to open in 2022. In 2022, it did not open, but the cost had risen to $1.53 billion. And now here we are in 2025 with a projected cost of $3.2 billion, and now it's slated to open in 2030. Members, we are facing a severe budget deficit. Most of the cost of this project will be borne, there will be, I believe, $1 billion from the feds if we get it. And otherwise, the cost of constructing this is borne by Hennepin County. I represent a lot of taxpayers in Hennepin County, and they are incredibly frustrated that the county would take this project on with, I mean, we haven't even gotten off the ground, and it's already, the costs have tripled, and that does not account for a story in the Star Tribune yesterday saying that they're going to need a new bridge design at the Theodore Worth Parkway, and that's going to cost another $50 million. Members, we can do bus rapid transit in this corridor for at least 10% of the cost. The F line in Representative Cagle's district is a bus rapid transit line, same specs as the blue line, 13 miles, 23 stations, $75 to $85 million. We should be considering bus rapid transit before we think about another mile of rail in light rail in this state. Bus rapid transit is flexible, it's much more affordable, it meets the needs of the communities. And just to level set again, the F line, $75 to $85 million for the entire 13 miles. The current projection on the Blue Line is $222 million per mile. Per mile. We could do the whole project for less than the cost of a mile of the fixed light rail. So, members, I appreciate your indulgence. This is a way we can save money for taxpayers, make the system more efficient. And also, I'm just speaking quickly on behalf of the members of, there's a group called the South Stop the Light Rail or .org, and they submitted testimony. It's in your packet. They wanted to be here, but they weren't able to rearrange their schedules. But there are hundreds of constituents who feel they are not being represented. So thank you, members, for listening.
Representative Robbins, I appreciate you bringing House File 14 to the committee. As we heard previously about the resources and the size of our transportation system is always searching for more dollars on all modes, and this is an attempt to make sure that those resources are used efficiently in the modes that people actually use more efficiently. Members and to the testifiers, on the agenda that it was listed on there, we're going to start with Mr. Shetnam from the Met Council. We will keep comments to 2 minutes as was posted in the rules, and we're going to be very strict on that. So I appreciate the Met Council. I'm sorry to keep you on a tight time frame as well, but we want to get this moving. Please introduce yourself and proceed for the testimony.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Metropolitan Council, and I am a bit under the weather today, so I will be keeping my comments pretty brief. But Nick Thompson, who's our project director for this, is unfortunately able to be here today, so I will be making his comments as well. But the Metropolitan Council is interested in seeing the regional transit system grow, develop, and be constructed. And the Blue Line Extension is a very important part of that. And what this bill does is that it would not allow that project to move forward, because it would place a restriction on the fact that any funds, that the council can't use any funds on the construction of this project. Right now, our county partners at Hennepin County are the local funding partner for us. That would mean that we would not be able to take those dollars and put those into this project. The project is currently in a planning implementation phase, and so since we aren't opening revenue operations on the Green Line extension or Southwest until 2027, that would mean that we would have a two-year delay to this project. So this would have to freeze, be suspended, however you want to look at it. We anticipate that for a project this size, that the cost of delay is in the, about the $100 million a year range, just based on inflation. And so looking at a two-year pause, we would expect that the inflationary cost of this would be at least in the $200 million range. That goes against what the council is interested in. We'd like to see this project move forward. We would like to see the regional transit system continue to grow. We believe that we've got a great opportunity with the passage of the regional sales tax last year, working with our regional partners to deliver on this project and others is the process that we'd like to move forward on. And so I just appreciate you giving me a chance to put those concerns on the record. And I'll stop talking because
Representative or Mr. Shetman, I do have a question. Is Representative Robinson's comments accurate that the state of Minnesota with the Met Council could build a bus rapid transit system along a similar route for significantly less money than a light rail? Is that true?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I am not going to get out in front of what I'm able to comment on, and Mr. Thompson would certainly be able to see that much better than I can. But
Mr. Shetman, is there a significant savings by using a bus system instead of?
Mr. Chair, members, the cost of building an arterial BRT lane or project here in the metro area is significantly less than building light rail transit.
Next, we have NAS. I'm going to get your name right. The more files we have, Nurakati.
Exactly right.
Okay, and then we will have Joshua Hodak, Irene Fernando, Hollins Winstons. Please be ready with your testimony when I call your name. Please identify yourself and proceed with the record. When I hold up this, it means you're out of time. Close up. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair, and the rest of the committee for having me again. My name is Nas, and I am the state policy lead for Move Minnesota and Move Minnesota Action. I am once again here on behalf of our organizations and our community of thousands of transit riders to oppose the moratorium on light rail expenditures as outlined in HF 14. We are witnessing a pattern of attacks against transit, against public transportation. It's not new. It's happened before. Elected officials want to move dollars away from transit investments, are drafting legislation that kills projects like the NLX, or are trying to halt work on any light rail projects. I have to ask, who are these proposals for? It is not for everyday Minnesotans trying to make ends meet, because on Monday in this committee, we were told that we're trying to make life more affordable for Minnesotans. The average car cost is going up. We're looking at about $10,000 to $14,000 a year for the average Minnesotans. And we also know that about a third of Minnesotans are living paycheck to paycheck. If affordability is really our priority, we should be bullish on transit investments, because people want and need to be able to get around without having to buy a car to do it. Over the past few years, I've conducted interviews with transit riders and non-transit riders alike. I've personally spoken to hundreds and hundreds of Minnesotans about their needs and wants, about their ideas and their fears. There are a great number of people I've met that have lived and worked along the blue and green lines that built their entire lives around it. When I was in college at the U, I used to work here at the legislature, and I couldn't afford a car, and light rail had made it possible for me. There are plenty of people like me, and there will be more. I ask you to oppose this bill and other bills that seek to undermine the transit system that so many members of our community rely on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Next up, we have Joshua Hodak.
I think you had it right the first time. It's Joshua Hodak. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Joshua Hodak. I'm the Senior Program Manager at Sierra Club, the oldest and largest environmental advocacy organization in the nation and in the state. We're talking a lot about the means but not the ends of light rail. So I want to talk about light rail being quiet. Its electric motors emit zero emissions, no loud or polluting fumes. Light rail carries significantly more passengers than a bus or miles of congested traffic on our roads. Light rail isn't phased by ice, or snow, or slippery road conditions. Light rail has a positive impact on economic development. I'll continue. Light rail complements bus service, the backbone of our metropolitan region's transit system. It's complementary. And transportation is the number one source of climate pollution in our state. And clean transit options like light rail are part of that overall solution. We need expanded service serving more communities. And HF 14 will leave federal money on the table for other regions to take advantage of. I urge you to vote no on this bill and support more, not less, options for getting Minnesotans to where they need to go. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. I apologize. I did skip over Councilmember Ellison. I did that by accident as Mr. Shetland was moved first. If you're ready to go, and then we will go to the commissioner.
Thank you all for having me. My name is Jeremiah Ellison. I'm on the Minneapolis City
Mr.
Council.
Ellison, please proceed.
Representing Ward 5, which is where the light rail will go through when it goes through Minneapolis. Last fall, all the cities along the Blue Line Extension, every single one of them, passed municipal consent for this project. And when it comes to, you know, intergovernmental relationships, when it comes to our regional partners, consent is really important for projects like this. Consent's earned really through a lot of public engagement. We don't take that lightly. It's taken many, many years to get to this point. And I also, speaking of many, many years, want to talk about how the Blue Line had to be realigned. That's a part of the delay. And when we talk about the rise in costs, delay is a part of that rise in costs. Maybe the biggest contributing factor to that rise in costs. So further delay is only going to put us in a less financially ideal situation. It's not going to save anybody money down the line. You know, we're now in the advanced stages of planning this route, where we are still doing further communication to in community engagement to make sure that we can not have things, disparate effects like displacement of communities and businesses. We're doing the engagement that we need to in order to make sure that this line is truly additive to the residents of, well, the residents of Ward 5, where I represent, but also every single resident along this route. I think it would be a huge disruption. I think it'd be a huge mistake for us to disrupt this project as it's moving forward. And I heard a lot of talk about the Southwest line, but this line is not dependent on anything regarding the Southwest line. We are on our own timeline. We are pursuing our own ends, and we are serving our constituents, along the line, diligently. Happy to answer any questions that folks might have, but I would encourage folks to make sure that we do not have any disruptions to the further development of the Blue Line Extension.
Councilmember, thank you for your comments and your testimony. Appreciate you being here today. Next, we have Commissioner Irene Fernando, Hennepin County, followed by Hollins Winston. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Kosnick, Representative Robbins, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Irene Fernando, Chair of the Hennepin County Board. Hennepin serves residents with efficient transportation options that meet the needs of our growing region. By investing in the construction of a comprehensive network of high-frequency transit lines like light rail and bus rapid transit, quality transit builds vibrant and thriving communities by increasing access to jobs while reducing disparities and traffic congestion. This project will extend the Blue Line from downtown Minneapolis through North Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, Crystal, and Brooklyn Park, efficiently connecting these communities to the broader transit network and the region's job, health, and education centers. Some of these communities have high rates of poverty and have been historically underserved and underinvested in. This project is a generational investment in our region's transportation system and residents. Light rail serves as the main arteries of our transit system. It moves people more efficiently and connects major destinations while feeding other transit modes. In fact, just the two existing light rail lines serve one-third of all transit rides in the metro. A successful transit system needs multiple modes working together to get people where they need to go. The communities along the route have some of the highest transit ridership rates in the state, with around 50% of riders without reliable access to a car and dependent on transit to meet their daily needs. The Blue Line Extension will also create thousands of good-paying jobs in construction and supplier industries and will ignite economic development along the corridor. Light rail projects uniquely stimulate millions in private economic investment. Since 2009, more than $12 billion of development in the region has occurred near light rail transit lines, including over 36,000 multifamily residential units. Transitway investment makes our region more competitive for the jobs and talent of the future. Light rail leverages billions in federal funding to Minnesota that would otherwise go to our peer metros like Seattle, Phoenix, and Austin. Last fall, we hit a key milestone with all municipalities voting to approve preliminary design plans. The strong support from elected officials shows the value this project will bring to our communities. Hennepin is committed to funding the local share of this light rail project to deliver rapid transit service to the corridor, our region, and Minnesota. We urge you to not delay the Blue Line extension. I very much thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony and your comments. Next, we have Mayor of Brooklyn Park, Mr. Hollins Winston. Please introduce yourself and begin with your testimony. Next up will be Mr. Aaron Wagner.
Hi, Mayor Hollis Winston of City of Brooklyn Park. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. I think aside from some of the environmental concerns of, you know, reducing congestion and emission, I think the Blue Line is incredibly important. And for our City of Brooklyn Park, that revolves around economics. That makes sense. So very quickly, if we look at our City of Brooklyn Park, 87,000 people. Bloomington is slightly bigger. They have $5.5 billion in commercial property values. We have $2 billion. $3.5 billion gap, that gets passed on to our residents, and that's not just a story for Brooklyn Park. That is a story for pretty much that entire region. Extensive research shows that light rail brings denser development, brings the right type of housing, whether affordable, workforce, or market rate, and it very much expands that tax base. So it creates opportunities for real equity. I don't know the new definition of equity that people use, but when we talk about owning businesses, we talk about owning homes, or people having jobs, this addresses that. Approximately 20% of all Hennepin County households within a car live within 1 mile of what will be the Blue Line extension. So this very much creates wealth for folks within the community. Brooklyn Park has made a commitment to this, and that's both in time and in dollars. And for us, time, our staff, also equates to dollars. So we will be putting $8 million towards this in terms of infrastructure improvements along West Broadway. We've enacted a substantial zoning changes. We've worked with Target, which is in our area up there, to kind of plan this out. And we actually are creating a biotech district along that line to take advantage of this opportunity. And numerous developers have said they look forward to the Blue Line light rail coming so that they can build that out. In addition, along that line, 27 to 32 city councilors have given consent for that, along with the county board. So that area is very much asking for this development. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak. And I'll just close on this saying that there are cities that have built out their tax base and sales tax opportunities already. The Northwest region overall deserves that opportunity and shouldn't just go to certain people. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Mr. Aaron Wagner, Robbinsdale City Council.
Thank you, Chair, Representatives. My name is Aaron Wagner. I'm on the Robbinsdale City Council. I just want to start by echoing the sentiments that Council Member Ellison shared. I fully agree with them. Ward 5 in Minneapolis and Robbinsdale share a border, and I can assure you that our constituencies are well represented. If you don't know about Robbinsdale, Robbinsdale is a small, tight-knit community with a small-town feel. And to illustrate that, our former mayor describes our downtown as authentic and human scale. The many small businesses and restaurants contribute to that spirit, and I encourage you to visit if you haven't. Increasing these connections to our downtown and our businesses to the greater metro area is why this project is important to Robbinsdale. I believe that our city's full potential will be realized with light rail. Not unlike the president's promise to usher in a new, quote, golden age for America. The specifics of this plan are still unfolding, but there is clear emphasis on increasing domestic manufacturing and prioritizing American-sourced inputs for that production. The hope is to increase high-paying jobs here at home. This project does all of that and more. A number of companies that employ Minnesotans will be working on the construction of the light rail extension and the corresponding private development that it spawns. These are good jobs that otherwise would not be there. For a small, fully developed city like mine, any new development is de facto redevelopment, and they are just more expensive to do. Builders need extra incentive to invest, and light rail access is that incentive. Just the hint of extending the blue line has breathed new commercial life into my city. And these investments don't benefit only my city or other cities on the route. Labor, materials, and other components for the extension and other developments are going to be sourced from around the metro and state. Workers from these projects will be spreading their paychecks everywhere. As great as Robbinsdale is, we don't have an H&M or an REI like Maple Grove does. We don't have apple orchards, but many towns in greater Minnesota do. That means project-generated wealth will be spread around. I want to make this crystal clear. This project is creating jobs and opportunity in America, not in another country, here, right now. To stall it would be a betrayal to the communities who are waiting for this and to the businesses who have invested in them. A new age, golden or otherwise, cannot be achieved with the same old infrastructure. Please do not stall this project. Thank you.
Thank you, Council Member. Next, we have Ricardo Perez. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ricardo Perez. I am a coalition organizer with the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability and help staff the Blue Line Coalition. Since 2013, the Blue Line Coalition has met monthly and many times way more than once a month to talk about the planning and development of the Blue Line Extension Project. And for us, the Blue Line Extension Project is not about a train, but it's about the people who currently live, work, go to church, or gather to pray across the corridor of Blue Line Extension Project. And we've met hundreds and hundreds of people who are very interested in seeing this materialize. Some of them have waited over 20 years since they first heard about this project. So we strongly believe that the corridor, that North Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park, Crystal Robbinsdale deserves a light train extension. And why? Because of the people, right? We've met entrepreneurs and small business owners who are excited to see their business grow or to start a new business. We've met seniors who are interested in helping getting quicker to their medical appointments with this train, or families who are excited to travel from Brooklyn Park all the way down to the Mall of America on the weekend. Well, today they cannot do that. So for us, the Blue Line Extension Project has become a vehicle for the imagination of these communities to move together towards the best version of what their neighborhood, their city, their county, their state can become. So we urge you to please vote no on the funding moratorium. Do not disrupt the efforts that go way back. Help us tell people in the corridor that we can work together to see this benefit materialize for all. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Perez. Andrea Young. Oh, excuse me, Andrea Young, if I said that incorrectly. Welcome to the committee. Say your name, state your name and your organization, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Andrea Young, and I am the executive director of the Heritage Park Neighborhood Association. I want to start by saying how important money is for the communities in which I serve. Last night, I attended a town hall meeting held by the senator and representatives of District 59. I listened to the community ask a few questions about funding and transportation projects like the Blue Line Extension because we are being made aware that you are in your budget season. The fear of funding and the Blue Line Extension not being funded was a surface level emotion in the room. Don't get me wrong, I don't want to sound like the community isn't resilient when it comes to figuring out funding, but I do think that it is important to keep our communities in mind when you make decisions about transportation and funding. We just listened to Representative Robbins explain as to why she suggests that the Blue Line should not be invested into, but the people of the communities that I serve deserve the same opportunities as the people that live along the Green Line. I watched on the news last night how there is a bill being pushed forward to alleviate some of the burdens of parents considering exemptions on things like car seats and other items. I just want you all to consider the alleviation that the transportation funding will also bring into the communities that I represent and the importance of the projects like the Blue Line Extension, because this project isn't just about transportation, but it is also about the people. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will have Alicia Alexi come next. And Representative Robbins, I just want to clarify your bill, just puts a pause until we figure out that we get the Southwest Light Rail operational and functional, a project that has been well known as a extreme boondoggle, three times the price, before we waste more money. But you have also suggested that there should be a bus line to serve people in transit in that area. So I just want to remind the testifiers of that fact. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I am Alicia Alexi, and I'm a policy advocate at the Housing Justice Center. And I'm here to express my opposition to Bill HF 14, which would put a pause on the Blue Line extension project. I actually took the Green Line light rail to get here to this hearing today, and I have been a lifelong public transit user, so I know the value of having accessible and easy to navigate transit options for those of us who are not car dependent. This bill would make fewer available options for reliable transportation for those who live along the corridor in Brooklyn Park, Crystal, Robbinsdale, and Minneapolis. There has already been a massive amount of time and effort spent on the Blue Line Extension Project from various stakeholders and community members, and it would be a shame for all of that to go to waste. We may not have the robust public transit infrastructure of cities like Chicago or New York, but our communities, especially those along the corridor, deserve the investment and the opportunities that the Blue Line Extension Project will provide. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We do have at least one member of the public that wanted to testify. Please proceed to the front, introduce yourself, and if there's anybody else, please notify the page. We will be voting and want to have a little bit of member discussion for about 15 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Ron Williams from Robbinsdale. I oppose HF 14, a temporary moratorium on Blue Line extension expenditures. I strongly advocate for this LRT going forward. It is the last of the LRT projects planned for the Twin Cities since 1970s to transport a lot of people efficiently, reduce congestion, and stimulate development for the region. After feedback from months of community workshops, the project managers favored LRT over BRT because ridership projections forecasted a need for light rail, and because the LRT would stimulate economic development while BRT would not. The current route is so much better than the one using BNSF because it multiplies the benefits to disadvantaged communities by going through North Minneapolis. Thus, the extension fulfills a major project goal of equity in public transportation for those who need it. There has been a concern that our trains are not safe because our society has spilled some of its social problems onto public transit. In 2023, the Minnesota legislature gave Metro Transit money to fight the homeless and the crime problem primarily on its trains. Since then, the Metro Transit police working with social workers have provided vouchers and other services to the homeless. Also, Metro Transit has partnered with 10 community-based organizations that have interacted with riders to provide service connections. Community service officers have been issuing administrative citations for non-payment of fees. In addition, security guards have been hired to report crime at Lake Street and four other train stations. But have these measures made any difference? Here is some evidence that they have. For 2024, crime fell by 6% from 2023. Along with that, the 2024 bus and train ridership rose for the third consecutive year, a nearly 6% increase over the previous year. In conclusion, the Blue Line extension will bring much-needed transportation service and development to its four cities, not crime.
I appreciate it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for your time.
You know, interestingly, a couple years ago when we were talking about this, I received a social media post from somebody I hadn't talked to in years from Robbinsdale that was strongly opposed to this and would much rather prefer a bus line and not the disruption. So there are opposing opinions on that, but I appreciate that's why we have public testimony. We have Representative Olson, real quick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins, for bringing forward this really responsible idea here. And here's what I'm looking at, and you might need to refresh me on the numbers, so this might turn into a question here. But I'm looking at some data, ridership data from the Met Council. I've got a nice little graph here that you can see has gone down significantly over the last, 80 years. And then I'm also looking at this subsidy per passenger report that the Met Council has put out. And I did some math, and I might be, I'm a social studies teacher by trade, so I might be wrong with my math here. But what I was looking at is the difference between creating and finishing this line versus using a bus rapid transit would equate to about, there would be a necessary ridership of 5 billion riders on this train before it equaled the investment of a bus rapid transit. So the cost of the train versus the cost of the bus, we would need 5 billion people to ride on that train at least one time in order to equal the cost. Now, if we want to look at this and we look at my nice little graph here, we see that there were about 50 million transit riders last year. 50 million, okay? And a third of those ride transit. So we do some math here. You take 50 billion divided by 50 million, and one third of that, it would take 300 years to equal the investment. A bus line versus a train, it would take 300 years to recoup our investment on the train. I don't think any of us are going to be around here 300 years from now. I think it's a very poor, very poor investment, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. I didn't hear a question. Next, we have Representative Jones, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for giving us this opportunity to talk about transit. So I think I'm the only member who is on this committee that represents a district that in which trains from this line will be going through their district. So, and I also represent a district that has the Green Line going through it. So let me tell you, I've had many questions and conversations with folks on the doors about the Green Line. I know there's lots and lots of challenges about that line. And so also want to think about, like, we are here to bring good governance to our state. And so I agree with you that we want to use our public funds astutely. I come from a family of small business owners. It's really important to them that our public dollars are used well, especially, when they're especially businesses pay tax dollars. So what I want to get to is identifying what the real problem is. Do you know what the main physical cause of the challenges of the Green Line were?
Representative Robbins.
I know what I read in the OLA reports, and I followed that quite closely. So a lot of it had to do with the apartment building that was too close to where they're doing the tunnel delays. But those challenges won't be the same as the challenges we see in this project. So I would just submit that this project isn't even off the ground, and they've had serious delays and serious increases in costs. So they've identified a $50 million challenge at a crossing just in the paper yesterday. So whatever the challenges will be in this project, they will certainly be there. And I think what we saw with the Southwest Light Rail is a good example that we should learn from. And rather than double down, we should take the lessons learned from Southwest Light Rail about delays and huge cost overruns and say we don't want to make that mistake again.
Thank you. 10 seconds, follow up.
Yeah, so thank you for that. I will say, so the main problem was that it's a tunnel underwater. The Blue Line is not going to have a tunnel moving underwater. So that is the main driver of all of the delays and the complications for the Green Line. So that is not the same that's happening on the Blue Line. I also wanted to ask, have you spoken to any of the biotech firms that Mayor from Brooklyn Park mentioned have been making investments because they're anticipating this LRT route?
Representative Jones, my understanding is if you're comparing the Green Line extension, the Southwest Light Rail, about $3 billion approaching. This project is about similar. I don't care if there's a tunnel or not. It's still $3 billion. We can do a bus cheaper. Representative Robbins, real quick.
I have not spoken directly with them about the line running through the Brooklyn Park section, but my understanding is that that is a lot of potential, but they need TIF districts. There's a lot of things that aren't lined up there yet, and my district, which is nearby, I speak to them. We're doing a lot of development in the biotech space, and I know they're very eager to continue to invest, and I think they would be, whether it was bus rapid transit or light rail.
Representative Papke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And first, I just want to say thank you to Representative Robbins for good conversation that we've had with regard to Blue Line Extension over the last couple years. We have had different goals in mind, but similar ways that we get down the path, as it were. And so we discussed last year this bill, and I was supportive of concepts of it, but with last year we passed, and I made you aware that we passed in statute 473.3999. We passed in there restrictions as to how the funding could go, and so I am extremely supportive of light rail and of building out our transit system. I think it's critical for all folks across the entire metro, all hardworking folks, to be able to have access to transit, and I am concerned, along with you, about the cost of the blue line there. And so with that, this is a Hennepin County project, and Hennepin County is making the decisions. We have a history in the metro of the counties being the one starting projects and moving them forward, and that is exactly what's happening here. And so we passed, if I can draw everyone's attention to the back page, page 2, subdivision 3 on under project cost. The second sentence there is the council must only use direct appropriations in law or federal sources to pay its portion of light rail transit capital construction costs. And what this does is it restricts the state.
10 seconds, Representative Tapp, you get to your question, please.
It's an important point to be making here, so
I appreciate it.
So with that, where we are at is that with this funding moving forward and this in the bill, it is restricting the ability of the state's money via the sales tax to be used on Blue Line unless it is directed by the state. And so I think that your bill is redundant and not necessary right now and doesn't meet the goals. I think it's a Hennepin County project and it should stay that way. And then second thing is that this has fiscal components to it. So if you look at line 1.6 on House File 14, Metropolitan Council must not expend
recording
any funds.
Stopped. And recording in progress.
This, it means it has fiscal components to it. I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, I move to amend the motion that we have today and re-refer this to Ways and Means instead of to the General Register.
There's a motion to move to Ways and Means.
I make a motion to amend the motion to move to Ways and Means instead of General Register as it was.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think I'm speaking in support of this motion. Last cycle, we appropriated $50 million to fund the Blue Line in 23, and 30 of that is unspent. And so presumably that would cancel back to the General Register. So this definitely has fiscal implications and must.
There's a motion to move the file to the General Register, to Ways and Means. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. Representative Cagle?
I'd like to make a motion then to move it to government operations.
There's a motion to move it to government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. I will call the question. Those in favor of moving House File 14 to the General Register?
Calling the question?
Yes. We've got 2 minutes left.
Mr. Chair, this is inappropriate. We are
it's okay.
Still...
It's moved. It's not debatable. Those in favor of moving House File 14 to Ways and Means, you can have a... The motion's already been made. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say...
Division.
No.
Division has been called. We will take a voice call, a roll call.
Representative Chair Kosnick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Myers.
Aye.
Wait, excuse me.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Fogelman.
Yes.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Jones.
No.
Representative Joy.
Yes.
Representative Kraft?
No.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Sensenmura?
No.
Representative Scraba?
Yes.
Representative Tadke?
No.
There being 8 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and we will be moving this House File 14 to Ways and Means. Excuse me.
That's good. All right. We got it. Great call.
The motion, the House File 14 will be moved to the General Register. We are out of time. Next meeting is February 17th, Monday at 1 o'clock. Congratulations.
Sorry, that was a little bit over.
We are adjourned.